Sammeln Faser werden am Deutschen geschrieben werden, und das war die Frage, die sich selbst klar zwischen den Reichen zu suchen in Deutschland. The bulk of the work actually has been done by my graduate student, Arun Panampanti. We collaborated with various people on bits and pieces of this work, with Jimmy Ram Whitman and with David Asalan in Rome, studying phase fluctuations of dissipation. If I get time, I'll come back to some work on the purity effects that I've been doing with the and maybe say a little bit of on the photo emission and the shift quasi-particle stuff that I've done with Mike Norman, Adam Kaminsky, Joe Aliso, and Monty Kahn. So, since Catherine said that we have to write down the questions, here they are. So we're taking a very traditional approach, ground state plus excitations. And you might even ask, why bother? Well, one way to say is, there's so many exotic things in these materials, perhaps it's a good idea to know if you understand the least exotic ones, and maybe it's like looking for the key under the lamppost, but that's what we do. So we know we have a D-wave superconductor, so we obviously have no quasi-particles, and we have rather small supertoy surfaces, so we probably have low-line phase fluctuations. And the first question is, are these phase fluctuations important at low temperatures? I'd like to ask the question whether they're quantum or classical in nature, and the role of dissipation in driving the field to classical nature. And then, actually, the answer will turn out to be no, that they're not important at low temperatures, as I try and convince you. The issue is, if all that one is left with is quasi-particles, then can we really account for all the properties at low temperatures in terms of that? And I think there are some puzzling aspects of that related to quasi-particle interactions and also treating disorder beyond the T-matrix. So that's, roughly speaking, the outline of the talk. If I don't get to some of the things, at least you'll know what I wanted to show. Okay, so for this audience, I think I can skip this motivation slide, but let me just go for it very briefly, quickly. So the evidence for Mohr quasi-particles, the very first piece of evidence actually came from Walter Hardy's demonstration detector. It's a very low temperature, the superfluid density decreases linearly with temperature. And then, this obviously is the most important thing to indicate the modes and Mohr quasi-particles given temperature dependence. The direct observation of the quasi-particles, well, perhaps not so direct, is by looking at the real part of the conductivity at low frequencies and at very low temperatures, or by looking at thermal fall effect, and finding that if you interpret this in reasonably conventional ways, then you come to the conclusion that you have quasi-particles with extremely long energy paths. And then there was this thermal conductivity measurement, which is another transport measurement, but this time in the presence of disorder, and then you would expect Karpov key to go to a constant value. Perhaps the most direct evidence for quasi-particles comes from photo emission. And although much has been said here, so many people have asked me about this in the past few weeks, but I thought, instead of showing you the data, I would at least show qualitatively what was done and why we are so convinced that we are seeing quasi-particles along the motor directions in this talk. And if you want the details of this, you should go to this paper on contact, the first half of this paper. Since we don't understand certain aspects of the photo emission, such as backgrounds when you block the EPCs, the best way to address this issue is to simply plot the intensity as a function of k, keeping the omega constant. These are the NPCs. So I'm taking some particle zones, subtracting the intensity at fixed energy away from the chemical potential as a function of k. These turn out to be extremely simple to interpret, you get beautiful lens and line shapes riding on constant backgrounds. There's no question that this is the background and this is the special function of the matrix. Then, by looking at how the peak shifts as you go down in energy from the chemical potential, you learn about the dispersion of these electronic states. And by looking at how the widths of this object change as you go down from the chemical potential, you learn about the line width of this object.
Can I ask a question? When you say Lorentzian on the background,
yeah.
Do you think there's physics in the background?
I don't think so, because if you have a you can easily show that if you have no photo emission matrix, benefit does not depend upon pay for particular civil service services. Along this path, then you would immediately get the reinstatement. And so what you're seeing is this factor function. And then this is some extrinsic pay. Now, I can go into detail of why I believe this is extrinsic. For instance, if you change the external photon energy, which you go, okay? The signal scales in a completely different way from which this guy scales. There's a very important experimental proof that this is extrinsic in origin and not tied to the spectral function that comes in. But okay, since
I don't have anything to tell you, since I don't know anymore, so.
Right.
We assume those.
So then you look at the dispersion of the lung and use the record and then as the heart. And you can actually do a quantitative analysis of the changes in the dispersion rate for the normal supermagnetic state and relate it via Brown-Strong to the change in the observed line width from the normal to the supermagnetic state. And since you do a Brown-Strong on the difference of two quantities, tails and so on in the Brown-Strong are contributing. So this is a very, very stringent test of this issue. And what you see is that although in the normal state you got omega plus constant at the temperature index from here, in the superconducting state, the line width shows a scale other than the temperature at which it gets suppressed below its normal state value. And the gamma strumming of this shows up as a thing in the dispersion in the superconducting state. Okay. So I think the evidence from our test is extremely strong that you have no carbon light. Well, then we say that why even bother about phase fluctuations? Okay, quasi particles is all that we should deal with. And let me give you the arguments that were perhaps made most persuasively by Julian Kirsten as to why one should at least think about the possibility of these being important flows. Okay, first of all, we know from the UMR graph that the superfluid density scales like PC, and this, like most others in the field, can be derived as scaling. X, okay, that's just a short form of that, meaning goes to zero upon under looping. This, of course, doesn't say anything really about whether the phase fluctuations are going to be brought at low temperature or not. This only says that somehow they're controlling DC. But if you look at the slope of the superfluid density at zero temperature, the linear slope, at least in YBCO, Don and Hardy showed around the world, and Lemberg showed some very nice unpublished data of this conference that we just had, was the extremely weak function of X. And this turns out to be a very natural consequence of classical phase fluctuations. If you assume that you have classical phase fluctuations, and you just look at the velocity modulus, which translates into the superfluid stiffness, of the classical XY model, and there's only one scale in the problem, J. And once you scale that out, then the slope here is a pure number. And that pure number seems to agree remarkably well with that observed in the experiments. Okay? And so here I've taken a picture from this paper by Robinson and collaborators, where they just do some Monte Carlo low temperature expansions on the classical XY model. And it's compared this with the bond hiding data and just show that it's observed. Now, the question is, why should phase fluctuations be classical? Why should this work out well? Yeah, so that's the best of the talk. Yeah, I agree. Right? So, exactly. Are you ignoring quantum interactions that would give you quantum mechanics, plasmons, etc., etc.? Okay. So, to address precisely that question, let's study autoparameter fluctuations in some more detail. I guess the point of view I'm thinking is that I know that quasi particles must contribute. But before deciding that phase fluctuations do not make an additional contribution, I should do some analysis to figure out whether or not there's any truth to what I'm hearing to say. So the approach we're going to take is that the form of the effect of action is studying autoparameter fluctuations, which is going to get from a quote-unquote macroscopic approach, doing a BCS mean field scale and doing fluctuations around it. But the coefficients in the effect of action are obviously going to be strongly renormalized by interactions, and so that we'll take as experimental approach to phenomena. Okay? So, I don't want any details on this. Basically, you just take a kinetic energy, you take an attractive interaction, you sort of separate the channel, and you take long-range Coulomb interactions, which is moving forward. And for a D-wave superconductor, you get a bond or a parameter, because it lives on bond, and you actually get four fields, fluctuations around the D-wave saddle point. You have amplitude fluctuations, and you have two phase fluctuations. It turns out, there are supercluster series. Okay. And at low temperatures, there are no vertices because there's a finite polar energy, and the only thing you have to worry about is longitudinal fluctuations, by which I mean spin waves in this XY. And for our purposes, you can actually set the very small stiffness along with the perpendicular direction to zero. You can put it in and it doesn't really change in the okay, so
I mean, is it obvious that the lowest harmonic, just the cosine, is really what you need, or really the first nonlinearity?
It is the first nonlinearity that we have.
We have a certain ratio between those and the Gaussian part. But
actually, the strict statement is the following.
because of this gauge transformation that you do, you lose the 2-pi periodicity of the phase. Is you can't really derive XY model at all. So what you do is you say at the core strain level, this is the simplest one you have, and then you match coefficients with the Gaussian theory that you did.
But why just using a pure cosine term rather than...
I don't think it will make any difference if I keep higher harmonics to the kinds of questions that I'm going to look at. It may make a difference if I was looking at vertices, but in any case, I'm doing skin wave theory, and I don't think it's going to make any difference to me if I keep higher harmonics.
Yeah, maybe you're right, yeah.
Okay, we know with peculiar higher order harmonics, you can drive first order phase transitions and so on at finite temperature, but I'm not interested in that. Okay, so then we treat the phase fluctuations within a self-consistent harmonic approximation, which basically says that the denormalized stiffness is given by the bare stiffness and denormalized by this factor, which is the mean squared fluctuation of the phase. Okay? Now, since I am in a D-wave superconductor, this guy itself has an intrinsic temperature dependence, a linear temperature dependence, and this can do whatever it wants to do, and it's given by this fluctuation propagator. And since inside this fluctuation propagator sits the renormalized J itself, actually you have to do some self-consistent numerics to it. But the answers are very easy to understand even without worrying about the numerics. Basically, you have two scales in the problem. You have a charging energy scale and a stiffness scale. Okay? So the quantum phase fluctuations turn out to be large, and they are large because both the coherence length is small and the superfluid stiffness is small. Okay? However, the quantum to classical crossover scale, this is just the zero point motion of a harmonic oscillator, and this is basically the level spacing in the harmonic oscillator. And the level spacing is given as the square root of the product of these two energy scales. And when you put in reasonable numbers, say for disco, basically you come to the conclusion that at least in the absence of dissipation, quantum phase fluctuations might be very large, but the classical regime is obtained only close to TC, and at low temperatures you can just completely forget about this, okay? And when you do the numerics, you find exactly that, okay? That you get a large effect on rho as zero, but a tiny effect on d rho as dt, and not possible to get linear behavior. And in fact, if you had an S-wave superconductor with these parameters for phase fluctuations, but no nodal quasi-particles, then, in fact, in a 3D or layered system, you would have got an exponential temperature dependence, or in a 2D system from square root 2 plasma, you would have gotten a T-fifth dispersion. So you're nowhere close to getting it. Now comes Gabby's question. What about dissipation? Okay, presumably coming from the quasi-particles and disorder itself, okay? Can it lower the crossover temperature so that classical thermal phase fluctuations dominate at very low T? The physical idea simply is you have some quantum harmonic oscillator. If you put in enough dissipation in it, basically make it classical.
This says that the classical classification only come in at 500K.
Well, okay.
So how do you explain this?
No, sorry. Of course, that's a cheat, right? It's a minimum of these two scales. Okay? Another way to say it is the following, that I should actually put the T-dependent stiffness here in order to calculate the crossover scale. I've actually put the zero temperature stiffness here. If I put the T-dependent stiffness here, I would have gotten some number around TC. Okay?
Okay, but TC therefore is still driven by thermal...
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And those actually, as you know, is driven by transverse thermal phase fluctuations. By transverse, I mean vortex, anti-vortex pairs in at least two dimensions. So not by the longitudinal ones that I'm considering. Okay, now to Gabby's question, dissipation. Okay, so the way a dissipation enters into a calculation like this is through the kernel of the gradient theta term, gradient theta squared term. Okay? Because that, if you remember, when you do the cumulative expansion, is a current-current correlator. A piece of it is the superfluid stiffness, but the rest of it is the regular part of the optical conductivity. Okay? And so you can relate it in this way. And you can keep more realistic the measures of, frequency dependence of the conductivity in the calculations, and it doesn't really change the results. So let me pretend, just for the sake of presentation here, that I'm just going to say there's some constant DC conductivity. Okay? Because in the experiments, if you look at real sigma at low temperatures, you either get Judah-like pieces or Lorentzian pieces, but centered such that you always have a finite DC conductivity. So let me just pretend as if that's the only important thing, okay? And it doesn't matter much whether I do it differently. And what that does is add precisely the term Gabi that you wanted, a mod omega n term here. Okay, and its prefactor is given by this three-dimensional conductivity multiplied by the layer spacing measured in units of p squared over h. And this action is actually completely different from the Emery-Kivelson action. Sorry, was there a question? Okay, I mean, I didn't do replicas and so on to come to this, okay? But all I'm trying to say is, so why would I expect to get a finite dissipation at low frequencies? I'm just taking that from experiments, that when I have D-wave quasi-particles and I have disorder, I get such dissipation. Okay, so this effective action is completely different from the one that Emery and Kivelson used, okay? In their action, in our action, okay, sigma enters to the current-current correlator in the gradient of the phase term. In their case, they just basically asserted that you should be screening this Coulomb interaction in the theta dot square term, okay? And when you just put in a screening interaction, you get a dielectric function, and the dielectric function is related to the longitudinal conductivity, and that's how dissipation entered their action, okay? I don't see how to derive their action from any microscopic model. There are specific models in which you could derive this, but I don't think they're particularly relevant to the case at hand. For instance, if you had a superconductor in proximity with a metal, said that there was no tunneling or anything like that, but Coulomb interactions were screening stuff going on in the superconductor, then presumably you could derive an Emery-Kivelson-like action. But if the dissipation is coming from the same place in which superconductivity is going on, then you get an action of the sort that I have done.
But your original couplings were sort of supercurrent, quasi-particle current couplings,
yeah.
Is that right? And then give you your grad theta squared times the
yes.
sigma. That's where they were coming from.
Yes.
In the more microscopic.
In the more microscopic, you just do a Hubbard Sirtanovich,
mm-hmm.
and then you just do a gate transmission, and you do a cumulant expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And the gradient theta square term will give you a current-current correlation.
Sure.
And that's where the dissipation is coming from. Okay, so let's make a quick estimate of this dissipation, okay? So from the bare bubble of Patrick's, if you put in numbers relevant to BISCO, you'll get some dimensionless dissipation like 25 or something like that, okay? If you look at what Joe Arnstein and collaborators have recently measured, you get a number which is more like 75. And they see this only over a narrow range of frequencies. But let's make a gross overestimate just to see whether there's any chance for this thing to work. So let's take, even multiply this by a factor of 2, okay, 150. And put it in over the entire range of frequencies that enter into this fluctuation propagator. As I said, we've done more realistic things. Suppose you do that. Then you come to the conclusion that the estimates that I was giving you previously changed. In the limit of such large dissipation, the mean squared fluctuation is no longer just given by, you know, the undamped harmonic oscillator result. In fact, it goes like 1 over sigma bar log sigma bar times this dimensionless ratio of the two energy scales in the problem. And of course, in the limit in which sigma bar goes to infinity, this will go to 0, as you would expect. Okay? For the numbers that we took, it's some number of order 0.1 instead of being of order 1. Okay? And the quantum to thermal crossover is now again being dictated by sigma bar. Okay? So the crossover scale becomes the in-plane stiffness energy scale divided by sigma bar. And if you take such gross overestimates of sigma bar, still the lowest you can drive this down is 5 Kelvin. Okay? And this is just a crude estimate. When you do the numerics, basically it comes down to say 20 Kelvin or something like that. So there's no way that you can get thermal phase fluctuations to give you linear penetration depths down to 1 Kelvin, as has been seen in experiments. Okay? And okay, here is some numerics. So if you had no dissipation, as I had said previously, we could get a large effect, 50% change in rho S0 with virtually no change in the slope. Okay? If you put in this very large dissipation, then you change the quantum correction here, which is a temperature independent correction, but don't do much to the slope. And if you had, again, suppose you had some hypothetical S-wave superconductor in which the basic linear temperature dependence was not coming due to quasi-particles, but coming entirely due to phase fluctuations in the presence of dissipation of this large magnitude, even then you get something which is very different from a linear temperature dependence, okay? So there DS is temperature independent. You can show analytically, and in fact the analytic curve is the black curve, that at low temperatures you get a T squared. Okay. And on a crossover scale of the form that I had shown you earlier, that T squared crosses over into a linear T. So you can analytically show that suppose you had no bare temperature dependence to your superfluid density, you'd get T squared from dissipation crossing over to a T on a scale which was given by J parallel divided by...
Without the quasi particles, the dissipation is wouldn't be so large anyway.
I'm just trying to do the best as I can to make the... I'm trying to be as generous as I can be to phase fluctuations and finding that it just doesn't work.
You are actually examining a specific model of dissipation, right?
I'm taking that from the experiment. As I said...
How can you distinguish between the dissipation from the quasi-particles and what you call like the direct temperature dependence of the quasi-particles? I mean, it's all mixed together, right? You have a model of phase fluctuation coupled to dissipation.
Fine.
And that doesn't work, that's what you said.
Fine. I know of no model of phase fluctuations coupled to dissipation which will work. Okay, that's I think a fair statement.
But can I ask you something?
Yes.
The phase fluctuations are coupled to the single particle type of excitations where you need really the transverse phase fluctuations. I think as has been shown by people like Juan Dorsey and many others, also Andy Miller.
No, I'm not familiar.
You are not really taking the transverse.
See, the transverse phase fluctuations are vortex anti-vortex pairs.
Yes.
But there's a finite core energy. So at sufficiently low temperatures, their contribution has to be down by an exponential. So I'm right now discussing only the asymptotic low temperature properties where I am perfectly free to ignore the vortices. As I go to higher temperatures, you're absolutely right, I'm not allowed to ignore them.
I thought with the flow of interaction, this quantum phase fluctuation should actually be activated. Why do you get a T square?
That was only with the presence of this dissipation.
Uh-huh.
If you don't put in the dissipation, then it would have been activated. And even if I take a strictly two-dimensional system with a square root U plasmon, I don't get activated, but I get T to the power 5. So I get a very large power law. Yes. And the way in which that you can do that T squared analytically actually. So there's this Matsubara sum that you have to evaluate and okay, I don't have any hand waving argument for T squared. Maybe you do. You're right. So then the whole situation becomes murky. But the whole aim was to try and get a linear T dependence. And the linear T dependence is pretty robust, right? Even in films and so on, people see it.
There's a more fundamental problem with the classical phase structure, but the entropy is 3K.
Yes.
That's a problem solved by Einstein 100 years ago.
there's a question of scales, right? Energy scales in the problem.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, how can you get around? I mean, how many degrees of freedom?
No, when you cross over from Zero point motion to thermal motion.
Yeah, and he's saying the energy scale is high, and that's why you don't.
That's why you don't.
Which, yeah, we say that if you want to push that scale down to 10 degrees, then you have to do it anyway.
Yes. That's right. I think the specific heat data, the error bars are rather large. So that's why I did not want to make an maybe example.
Yes, they're rather large.
Okay, fine. Fine. Okay. So now that we have decided that phase fluctuations are absolutely not important no matter what you do. So then we should be able to understand things quantitatively in terms of quasi-particles alone. And does that work? Or how far can you go? Okay, that's the next question. So as we all know that when you have the Dirac cone, you get a density of states such as Vf, V delta, where Vf is the dispersion perpendicular to the Fermi surface, V delta is the slope of the gap, which is sort of parallel to the Fermi surface, and grows linearly with omega. Now, with photon emission, you can actually measure both of these quantities independently, Vf and V delta. And with Joel Meso, 3 years ago, we actually embarked on a project where this was done systematically for all the available samples at that time. Okay. Now, it is important to note that this is the previous generation of experiments where the momentum resolution was not as sharp as what you've been seeing in the last 2 years, and so presumably all of this should be redone. But in any case, that's the best that exists right now.
So let's see. At the beginning you showed us that.
That's new data.
That's new. Yeah. So that's going to change VF.
It doesn't change VF.
It doesn't change VF at the node?
No.
Why not?
Well, because even with the old data, it was done carefully enough that you got the VF right. Okay. All I'm saying is that systematic doping dependence of all of these parameters has not been tested with the new set of data. This paper was submitted in 98 or something. Okay. In principle, if you had specific heat, then you could get the product. Okay. And then I would like to discuss two things. One is the superfluid density, where I think there is an issue of Fermi liquid correction, and the second is the thermal transport, where I believe there is some problem of going beyond the self-consistent T-matrix approximation, which is how the disorder has been most frequently treated. So this is Meso et al., old data. So this is like VF was measured. VF is relatively easy to measure, but you have to do a lot of work to get at V delta. You have to look at the gap in photo emission for a range of dopings, make fits, and decide what the slope of the gap here is. And this was done systematically for 7 samples, 6 of which are shown here. Maybe this is too many pictures. Okay, we can keep this aside if people want details, look into it. Let me just try and summarize it quickly here. So here's the superfluid stiffness, and in principle it receives 2 corrections, one sitting in front of the zero temperature piece, and another from the current renormalization, which sits as a square in front of the temperature dependent piece. Now, if you look at near optimal TCs, what photo emission found was that VF was 1.5 eV angstrom, which is 250 kilometers per second, as Louis Taillefer told me. I like that number. And VF over V delta is 20. Okay? And remarkably, from Taillefer's experiments on the thermal transport, he got a VF over V delta for optimally doped disco, which is 19. So I think this is quite remarkable agreement, and people who say that photo emission is ill understood, surface dominated junk have to pay attention to them. Oh, I'm preaching to the converted, sorry. Okay. Now if you take this input and put it in here, you find that you have quite a significant Fermi liquid correction here, which is roughly half. Which means if I were to describe the penetration depth in terms of purely non-interacting quasi-particle excitations, I would have been off by a factor of 1/2 in getting the slope of the rho SDT correctly.
But this is not the interaction between the quasi-particles. This is the interaction of the quasi-particles of the Fermi C.
Okay. Sorry, you're absolutely right. It's It's basically that when you try to move.
In a normal state sometimes.
Landau quasi particle.
It's a Landau.
Yes, it's a Landau quasi particle. So, okay, the word quasi particle is being used in two ways, Bogliubov and Landau. So,
no, ultimately, in saying superconducting state, any description, even said superconducting state, should be based on the non interacting theory of BCS quasi particles and the residual interactions.
And a normal state should not come into discussion.
Because I don't know. But, right? That, that's exactly my point. This renormalization is out of is inherited from the normal state.
Within some BCS approximation.
Yes, within BCS.
Right, but if we don't want to rely on that, we can just say that, you know, whatever happens in the normal state, and even the superconducting state, there will be some interaction between quantum particles.
Well, that is a parameter. It's a
then
parameter.
It's a parameter.
Right. That relates your current to the velocity.
Exactly.
It's just saying that the current carried by velocity is not the velocity.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
What is beta?
Okay, I'll just come to that in a second.
You
still? Yeah. I mean, basically, if you think in the way in which...
No, I know what it is. What is the number?
That number people just get from more and more and say it scales like X.
No, but...
Just from like this here. From here you cannot determine it.
No, I mean, if you can determine the velocity, you can determine M star. And we're using the Fermi-Liquid framework, M is your density of electrons.
Okay, I think we can discuss that, Jandeep, but we haven't done that.
The second term only involves a node. The first term involves
The entire.
That's
interpretation, right? Also, that formula is interpretation, but it doesn't go like that. No, I know. I just want another number.
He wants to know
because there's a picture behind this, which is the standard Fermi liquid picture of Leggett and company. So I wanted to know how big would be. How different is the 1 plus F1 coming from the beta and coming from the alpha to compare just the numbers.
Okay, so we did do one, but I wouldn't publish it.
Okay,
I can show you some numbers. Okay, so at optimality, beta F would also be of order half. Okay, and I can show you some graphs also. Okay, I wasn't planning to do that. But what is interesting is that with underdoping, and we didn't do a very large range, I mean, which was the range of available samples goes back to the issue that Cam was raising, that people do not have highly underdoped samples. Okay, so the lowest TC went to was 75 Kelvin underdoped, and on the overdoped side, I guess it was something like 80 Kelvin overdoped. Okay? What? Yeah, go ahead.
How do you define BF? Is that just when gamma invariant BF is 1?
Can I not define? Beta F is not very important for...
Okay. If it were gamma invariant, what would beta F and alpha F be?
Fine. Let's first do that, okay? Let's do that. So this lists all of that. Okay. So you are right. If it was Galilean invariant, then beta F would be precisely M star over N.
What are those?
Okay, so that in a Galilean invariant system, it would be the full current. Because there's this Landau sum rule, M star over M is 1 plus F1S over the dimension. That's what determines it in a Galilean invariant system. In a Galilean invariant system, the zero fluid, the zero temperature superfluid density is absolutely the bare object, N over M, because everything is fancy. Okay, so if you take an isotropic two-dimensional Fermi liquid, then it receives this correction. Beta F would be 1 plus F1S over 2, and alpha F squared would be precisely the square of that object. Okay? And in experiment, what you find is, well, if you interpret experiment in this way from Uemura, beta F scales like X, but alpha F doesn't scale like X squared, and this boundary was highlighted first by Mendes and Kobold.
Okay? M
star would do no from photo emission. From specific heat, if you could, but from photon emission, you can just look at the, right? For the quasi-particles, you know the dispersion. This is the physical mass.
The VF is a renormalized velocity, not
rare
velocity.
See, VF, these are the renormalized velocity. See, you know KF, you know VF, physical KF, physical VF, so you know M star.
But you don't know M.
Yeah. You don't know N. So N, you think, because you have the large underlying Fermi surface, N scales like 1 plus X.
Yeah, probably not, but
what do you mean probably not?
There's no gamma invariant, so that...
No, but because it's not Galilean invariant, therefore n still scales like 1 plus x, but the scaling of the superfluid stiffness like x comes from this Fermi liquid correction within this way of thinking about it. You see what I'm trying to say? Okay, we can discuss that point. So if you look at microscopic theories, okay, there's large N, TJ, Gabby and Marco Grilli did it, U1, SU2, you find rather different predictions, okay? And of course, everyone, since they know from experiment, they should go like X, find that it goes like X, okay? But you see differences here. Okay? And actually, if you just do pure phenomenology, then of course, these are completely unrelated, and you can show that you can get anything that you want. Phenomenology does not constrain this coefficient to go like the square of the other coefficient at all. Okay? You don't agree with that? I can argue with you in detail that that's correct. Okay? I'll tell you why it's correct. Basically, if you have a system with square symmetry, okay, then the f function depends not just on k minus k prime, it depends upon k and k prime.
No, I know, but there's a very simple argument.
Yes.
Of basically Leggett, you just look at your expression exactly at TC.
Yeah.
You evaluate the expression for the current correlation function exactly at TC, and then you see that the two coefficients are related because at TC, gauge invariance is restored.
Sorry, at TC, even this formula doesn't hold.
No, but there's a general expression which was derived by Leggett many years ago, which basically starts from a Fermi liquid, creates superconductivity as a residual interaction, and then expresses the current correlation function of the superfluid in terms of Fermi liquid interaction.
No, I'm very familiar with that, Gabby, but that assumes isotropy.
No, but you can extend
then
that.
Then that's exactly what we've done.
Fine, but then you evaluate those expressions exactly at TC, and you find that since you have to restore gauge invariance, at TC, the two coefficients are not really independent coefficients.
I don't think that's correct. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to push this description near TC at all. That's the other thing.
That's what Leggett does.
No, second term only is a valid.
I know, but you can say you can replace that by the bubble, basically, which is what Leggett does. That's just the low temperature expansion of the bubble.
Yeah, it is, I agree. That this is the low temperature, if you want to do it that way, but I don't think that you get constrained in a system without isotropy.
You don't get values, but the two things are related because the magnetic and the paramagnetic part of the current have to cancel exactly the DC. So I don't think they're independent parameters. That's the reason why in the isotropic case, both one is given by 1 plus F0, and the other one is given by 1 plus F1, and the other one is given by 1 plus F1 squared. It's precisely that.
Yeah, but at least if you take a an isotropic Fermi surface,
yes,
and a Fermi function that goes all, change all over the map, then the two numerically are not the same.
No, but at TC,
they're both different integrals.
They're exactly different integrals, but the things have to match at TC.
Because this thing,
exactly,
this thing, the nodal thing, knows only about the behavior
of quasi-particle at the pi-half-pi. There it is. And that's this. See, if you look at the current phenomenalization, it knows things only about.
So it is not related. It's not something that is the same, but it's not this.
Are you just saying that at TC everything's gapless, so the whole Fermi surface contributes to both the term?
I'm saying there are no free parameters. I mean,
no, different things contribute near DC.
There are different integrals,
but at low temperature, this alpha involves only the nodal point. Therefore, it's not related to what you think at DC. But if you take only one Fourier component, then you're right. So that's an escape route.
I mean, given that the normal state is not a Fermi liquid,
we won't want to do this.
We don't want to do this. What's
that? Out of this.
No, I do. No, I can do it. Phenomenological parameters.
Exactly. Not constrained by,
not constrained
by symmetry.
And then turn on
your view. You force him to explain the beta.
Okay.
Well, I want to see how he defines beta, and I still don't understand that. How do you find M star? Is that the M star?
Yes.
Okay, well, fine, you can define it that way. I'm not sure that's relevant.
Yeah, where do you put the M star?
Go on.
Okay, but still, there is an experimental puzzle. So let me just come to that puzzle, okay? Which is that if Vf over V delta is indeed doping dependent, and I in fact skipped that slide because of infinite number of questions, but it is doping dependent, okay? And it's doping dependent not only from photo emission in bismuth 2212, but it's also doping dependent from the thermal conductivity of diapers. Then why should the slope not be independent? I mean, then why, how come the slope?
There is some dependence, that it's not exactly.
Okay, but still, so I think we really need more and better data on these parameters to constrain this issue experimentally. And theoretically, I think it would be extremely unsatisfying if we have to appeal to a cancellation in the x dependence between these two to get this. That means we really don't understand this. If indeed experiments come out this way, saying that this is strongly underdoped, where there isn't that much data right now, but the trends are that this seems to depend on x, this seems to depend on x, and yet this is weakly dependent on x. So I think this is something we have to wait for. Maybe it's not a mystery if the experiments turn out this way. The other mystery, yes.
Writing that slope of sulfur experiment
based
on what we did is also based on some ECS type theory.
Yes.
Inside the superconductor.
Inside the superconductor. Inside the superconductor.
He's not working.
That is what alpha is. That is the alpha coefficient.
You've written the coefficient as alpha squared times Vf over V delta, motivated by BCS theory.
But I am doing BCS theory in the superconducting state. I thought I was allowed to do that, but I want to see how far it goes, okay? If it doesn't work, then we learn something. Okay, the other thing that you might have expected, the other puzzle is that you might have expected alpha f to go to zero as x vanishes. Because if you at least one might have thought that as you underdose sufficiently and you're losing the quasi particles, then maybe the current carried by the quasi particles is also being lost by you. But perhaps this is not true. Maybe you are losing quasi particles, but each of them is able to carry the full current, which is why alpha f does not vanish in the limit that x goes to zero. But I think this is, I think, an important question that we have to understand better. That what, I mean, I know that Patrick has a microscopic theory in which alpha f does not vanish as you go to zero doping, but I don't have any physical picture of why or how that's happening. Okay, I should find out. Okay, last 10 minutes. Thermal transport. So let me end up with a puzzle on thermal transfer.
Sure. The way alpha f vanishes, I mean, at the superconducting state transition on the underdoped side,
yes.
That's a very interesting question. I just want to, and it really depends on what kind of phase you're going into.
Yes.
I think that's open and interesting.
Yes. But I think it's experimentally going to be, only point I'm making is even by looking at the boring world superconductor in detail, we may learn something about the mysteries of ITC. Okay, so let's look at thermal conductivity. Now here, as Patrick and others showed, if you look at kappa over T in the low temperature limit, it's just given by Vf over V delta plus V delta over Vf times a number which is independent of this. And as was shown in this very nice paper by Durst and Lee, in fact, there are no alphas and betas. So if you don't like them, you should be very happy about it, because they just don't appear in here. But, so there is a but. Okay. This formula, to my mind at least, depends upon the validity of using the self-consistent T-matrix approximation to treat impurities. Because it's only in that case that at least I get a physical picture of this, that I get a finite density of states, a disproportional number of impurities that I have a scattering rate which is determined by the impurities, and the impurity concentration cancels out, and I get this number independent. So the question to raise is, well, how sure are we that the self-consistent T-matrix approximation is valid for treating dirt effects in very short coherence when superconductors? And let me make the case for why I think there's a problem here.
Not to mention D-wave.
Okay. So what we did, and this is work done with Amit Khoshal and Nandini Trivedi, is that we solved the Bogle-Bauer-Dijan equation. Okay, we did it completely self-consistently, didn't assume any particle hole symmetry, worked on lattices up to 30 by 30. We put in a unitary scatterer in a B-wave BCS Hamiltonian, and we asked, what do we get? And let's just focus on this panel here. What you find is that you get a very spatially inhomogeneous response to impurities in a short coherence sense of the field. Okay, what the self-consistent T-matrix theory tells you is that it assumes that the order parameter is uniform in space, and if you put in lots of impurities, the order parameter just gets suppressed. Here, because of the short coherence length, what you find is that locally the order parameter is heavily suppressed, but on a coherence length, it's back to where it was. Okay, and you can see that. So if you take just one impurity, the order parameter is suppressed only in its vicinities. The interesting low-lying excitation is the bound state studied by Balatsky and company. If you put more and more impurities, what you find is that you are sort of just punching out holes into the superconductor. Okay, and the low-lying excitations, I'm only showing you one of them in each case, is just given by hybridizations of these Balatsky resonances. The effect of this, and this is something that actually Catherine and John and others had discussed long ago, is that superfluidity is able to persist to much higher concentrations of disorder than would have within the self-consistent matrix approximation. So the spatially inhomogeneous response gives you an idea why these systems are so forgiving and insensitive to disorder. Because even though you have described superconductivity in patches, if you make a global phase twist, that information is able to propagate way beyond where the self-consistent T-matrix theories are said that the octagonal long-range order should have vanished or that the superfluid stiffness should have vanished. Okay? Now that you might say is just a quantitative effect. I think actually it's a nice thing because prior to the beautiful phase coherence experiments, nobody believed that this was a D-wave superconductor because people thought that impurity should kill you. And this, I think, is probably a very good reason why impurities don't kill you even when they are intentionally put on the planes on a unitary scatterer or don't kill you as much as you thought they would. But there is a qualitative effect also of this same physics. And that shows up in the density of states. Okay? And similar results were presented by Peter Hirschfield at this conference. What you find is that sort of like the self-consistent T-matrix, you get a constant density of states, but then at very low energies, you dig a hole in the density of states. Then you're away from the particle hole symmetric point. The background constant is itself actually much smaller than what you would have gotten in the T-matrix, but that's a quantitative effect. But this hole is a robust feature. Okay? And the scale of this little dip in the density of states seems to be independent of the impurity concentration, and in fact is the same as the scale of a single impurity bound state by putting an isolated unitary scatterer. Okay. Now, that scale is a very large scale, or can be a very large scale in the experiments, as you know from Chalmers Davis's experiments, that's a millivolt. Okay. So, then I don't understand.
Let me translate.
Yes.
So the width of the frequency of this.
Okay, so actually we can't, given our numerics, I cannot tell you what the form of the density of states is.
The width. What's that?
But I'm just saying, what is the scale on which I get this structure?
Yeah.
Okay, and that scale is the same scale as if I put in a single impurity, I would have gotten this Balatsky bound state, the energy of that with respect to the density.
Right. Yeah.
And that we know from experiment is large. Okay, then the question is, if the density of states of the chemical potential in fact vanishes, then why does one get thermal conductivity over temperature, which is constant?
And when you say large, what do you mean? Like what temperature?
1 millivolt is a large
so
energy.
So it's 10 degrees, or is this it's only...
This thing is a mini Kelvin.
Actually, there was a new experiment by the French guys
behind
that are they get the thing to go to zero.
That's right.
It's a different material.
It's 12408. I forgot to add that here. Thank you, Gabby. You're absolutely right. Now, what Pfeiffer tells me is that they haven't really gone to as low temperatures as Pfeiffer's group has gone to.
Yeah, but it looks different.
But it does look different. Okay? So there is some mystery in the thermal conductivity too. So okay, maybe I should just...
Where's your bound state added energy? Calculations or
The bound state is this. Okay, I am not showing you a single impurity, but it would have sat here.
Are you sure that your result is, result of actions?
Absolutely.
I do remember that. He was saying, you know, to see this tip, you need to look at large, he saw the result.
No. In fact, our results completely agree with him. See, 10% is a large disorder on the scale of T-matrix theory. T-matrix theory would have said at 10%, but you see it even at 4%.
Is that Polanski stable in a positive energy?
Okay, actually it has pieces at both places. Yeah.
But isn't 4% a live disorder compared to experiments?
I actually don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question.
But okay, it may be, but nevertheless, all I'm saying is that within self-consistent T-matrix theory, 9% for these sort of parameters is where superconductivity would have vanished. But superconductivity is perfectly robust. I mean, it's diminished.
I'm confused. You're trying to tell us that T-matrix approximation is very bad, but quite different from...
Yes.
But 3 years ago, I mean, I remember several talks by Peter Hirschfeld. He was fitting pretty much everything.
He gave a talk 3 days ago,
something else.
It's self-consistent.
Where he said that it doesn't work at all.
Self-consistent in
the
BCS equation.
No, I understand what he's doing. I know, but that was not needed by an experimental lead. At the point that at least the picture that they were giving is that everything was understood by D-wave military scatterers in D-matrix approximation.
D-matrix is an approximation to a theoretical calculation. He's showing you that the theoretical
calculation... No, but that means that there's a problem.
Yes, there is a problem.
There is a double problem.
There is a double problem.
The theory
That's what I'm saying, and that's my summary slide. Okay?
So when you do theory better, the results get worse.
But in a very physical way. No, it's not just do theory better, the results change. They change in a very physical way. Okay, which you understand.
Yeah,
I don't know what to say about that.
A lot of experiments, or was that just one theory?
No, this is based on BCS theory.
Okay, wait. But then I think then that's already making a very important statement. That the superconducting state, okay, at least insofar as, say, impurity effects or other things are concerned, cannot be described by BCS theory. That would be a very important statement to make, then. Mm-hmm. That's not the consensus in the field. Okay, either you say...
In the field theory, when you self-consistently determine what parameter...
Yes.
It's not so getting quantitative.
You never get OS, right, from this theory, right?
No, that's a slightly different thing, Patrick. That's different from okay, because you're certainly allowed to choose parameters phenomenologically or as input from experiment. But this seems to be suggesting that either there's something wrong with this.
BCS theory, you know, was data is a permanent theory. And the way you kill the superconductivity says that you have a normal quasi-particle permanent state inside your impurities. And we know that that cannot be true.
Okay, fine. So what you're saying is that since you're really probing short distance physics of how you kill superconductivity, BCS theory doesn't work here, or say in the vortex core or near a strong scatterer.
Exactly.
Okay, that may well be. Okay, but for instance, this Fermi liquid parameters one is actually probing some long wavelength, low frequency property where you might have thought that BCS theory should work, and there also it's not 100% clear to me that things are working as well as they should.
Why do you say that?
I say that because I seem to need some kind of miraculous cancellations between parameters. Maybe experiments tell me that I don't. But I'm not sure that that's true.
I'm getting confused.
Yeah.
There's BCS and there's Fermi liquid theory. You somehow marry the two together.
Yes.
And okay, and you're arguing that phase fluctuation, which is where some collective degrees of freedom are not important,
right.
The single particle excitations are important.
Right.
Is that the same?
That is. So the whole idea was to see to how far can you take BCS plus low-lying excitations.
No, but the first part of the talk is independent of BCS theory. That's probably generous.
Because we like the.
Quantity particle coffee.
Taking a DOI-BCS spectrum to begin with.
The spectrum, yeah, but.
It's not a Fermi-liquid spectrum, it's a BCS.
No,
D-wave BCS.
If you just look at the spectrum, okay?
Right.
You have a D-wave gap and you have sharp quasi-particles everywhere along the Fermi surface. Everywhere along the Fermi surface. And
but it's not Fermi surface, it's Fermi point.
Okay, let's put it this way. Experimentally, at least, there is a notion of a Fermi surface above DC, even if there aren't sharp quasi-particles.
Okay, fine.
Okay? And the gap in the superconductor, and let's just stick to slightly overdose samples for a second, or optimal dose samples, okay? The superconducting gap opens up on that Fermi surface within the resolution of that experiment, okay? And I measure the gap that way, otherwise how would I even know how to measure the gap if I didn't know where to look in momentum? I mean, in principle, you could measure it everywhere in K-space, but you can't do that experiment. So, that's why I say that all along that normal state Fermi surface, I get a D-wave gap and sharp quasi-particles. So it's a good zeroth order starting point to say that my ground state is adiabatically connected to a D-wave BCS superconductor. And I'm just exploring the limits of that statement. To what extent is my ground state adiabatically connected to a D-wave BCS?
Okay, but now when you look at the excitations,
yeah,
you are freezing some degrees of freedom that you know are there, phase degree of freedom. This is an approximation you're using.
But I just argued, at least my satisfaction, at least if not yours, that the phase degrees of freedom are not important for the very low temperature.
Okay, so it's an approximation that you're freezing.
Yes.
Beyond
phenomenology.
I thought you're doing theory, not
it's phenomenology in the sense that I derive an effective action
right,
based on quote-unquote microscopics, but take its parameters from experiments.
Okay.
Okay, so if you want to call it phenomenology, that's fine.
It's not a
theory. What?
Doing BCS theory is bad, but doing phenomenology is good.
Okay, I have a technical point, which is probably a minor detail, but I remember in this MISOL data which you showed, you actually needed longer range than nearest neighbor Coulomb pair interactions. So my question is this consistent with the assumption of the nearest neighbor BCS, which you probably put in your phase driver?
Strictly speaking, not, but I don't think anything will change based on that. Nothing will change based on that. I mean, that's a detail which one can build in. That detail is important when we study BDFO, V delta, but I don't think that detail is at all important when you study the phase fluctuation. Okay, thank you. Thank you.